for catching that. But it certainly doesn't make any sense who it is. Not only that, but to have a chi before a sigma is kind of taboo, too. Did you happen to check and see if that form's in the... Okay, it's narrow then. Okay, everybody, if you want to make a correction in your textbook, Mark found an error in the Venerable Manuscript here. And page 291, the last verb form in the column there on tasso, they've got tetaksai, which is not a kosher form there. So that should be switched. The sigma and the alpha should be switched. Should be tetachasi. Tetachsai would be not proper at all. Yeah, right. Yeah, you'd have an xc there. I mean, you wouldn't have a chi sigma combination anyway. It would be turned to xc or something. So, make that correction and your book will be okay. Okay, good. Well, today continue here in chapter 48 on these reciprocal pronouns and so forth. We were looking at the bottom page 297. It's one of those catch-all chapters that's kind of throwing several different things in here. Reciprocal pronoun, we've dealt with the reflexive pronouns, and we dealt with idios, and now looking at the reciprocal pronoun, ale alone, is they kind of pretty much have to give the genitive form as the dictionary form because there is no nominative form. And we looked at the examples of ale alone itself. Then you'll notice in this paragraph, just below the examples of ale alone, says the meaning of the English each other is also sometimes expressed in Greek by the third person plural of the reflexive pronoun, and sometimes by the phrase heis ton henna. Now, first of all, this reflexive use of the third person plural of the reflexive pronoun, it takes you back to what we saw in the previous section there, the reflexive pronouns, doing something to yourself. And so he's saying you could translate this each other. Again, I don't know. If I'm going to try to do an accurate translation, I don't know if I would translate it each other just because you have all alone for that. But look at the example he gets, 1 Corinthians 6, 7. Krimata ekete meth he auton. You have lawsuits with each other. Well, that's pretty much the idea in English, but literally what would it be translated with he auton? Yeah, with yourselves. You have lawsuits with yourselves. And, of course, you get the idea there. They're having lawsuits within the church, among themselves. But it's literally with themselves, and ale alone could have been stuck in here to get the idea of each other. So, yeah, he just, again, it's typical of this loose translation type of philosophy where, well, you can do it this way, too. But I'm not so sure that I'd want to be that loose about it. It may not make a gigantic difference in a particular issue, but in some instances it conceivably could. Now this phrase heis ton henna, of course you've got one the other is kind of the other, the idea one the other, or excuse me, one the henna. You see, you've got two forms of one to one, or one on one, or one the one, one in the nominative and then one in the accusative. So the idea is one's doing the action to the other. So that's kind of an idiomatic expression. The whole thing is kind of just functioning as an adverb. And that's an interesting idiomatic. And one another might be a good way to translate it. Build up one another here. Haste on henna. Build up, be building up one the other. And that's not, you know, too far away from English idiom. One the other, build up yourself, one the other. So build up one another. I think that's pretty straightforward. Okay, now this next section, question, John?
I was just going to mention. Mm-hmm. You need to worry too much about that paradigm. There aren't any of those ones listed in there.
Oh, okay.
No perfect.
For that verb?
For that verb at all.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about it. That's maybe why he didn't proofread it real close. Or somebody missed it. Okay. Section 378. Indefinite pronouns, adjectives, and adverbs. The indefinite pronoun and adjective in the New Testament is tis, whose case forms are identical to those of the interrogative pronoun and adjective tis, except for accent. So here's another instance where accent makes a difference. Back in section 303, of course, we had the paradigm for the interrogative pronoun, and what was the function of the interrogative pronoun?
Call.
Yeah, asking question. It was an asking a question, and when you want to say who did this or etc., you use the interrogative pronoun. Now that same interrogative pronoun with a different accent pattern can be used as the indefinite pronoun, where you get things like any, anyone, anybody, anyone, someone, someone, a certain person, a certain thing, a certain man, whatever. Where you're not specifying specifically who it is, it's functioning almost like some of the relative pronouns, some of the senses there, where you get this kind of an indefinite element to it. But it's got an even more indefinite aspect to it, you might say, whoever, anything, anyone. And so here's the paradigm for it, and it's pretty straightforward. It's just exactly like you saw before, except that the accent is either shifted or it's not there. If it's monosyllabic, there's no accent on it. If it's disyllabic, the accent will be on the last syllable, or just don't eliminate it altogether, and you may have the whole thing with no accent. So your pattern is tis, tinos, tini, tina, tines, tinon, tisi, tinas. And if you compare that to your paradigm on page 303, you'll just see that the accent on the other paradigm was always on the iota, the first syllable. So it's just a matter of accent shift. Or you can see the forms with no accents at all. And this course can make for some questions, because remember the accents, as far as the original unsealed are concerned, it looks like the earlier ones at least didn't have accents, the ones that we were relying the most upon for our text. And the only difference sometimes between a question and a statement with an indefinite pronoun like this would be the accent. Because we've already seen the situation with questions and how ambiguous they can be, and the same thing can happen with these. So just have to keep on your guard for the possibilities. Okay, and then looking at examples here, section one here, when used as a pronoun, the indefinite tis or ti corresponds to English any, anyone, anybody, anything, some, someone, somebody, some, something, one, a certain one, a certain person, a certain man, a certain thing, certain, certain ones, certain people, etc. So it's got this idea of indefiniteness, and it says in selecting one of these possible translations, one must be guided by the context. So you just have to look at the context of the thing to specify exactly how you want to render it. Matthew 12:29. We'll look at a few examples here to get some sense for this. Post dunatai tis asel thane astein oikian tu is huru. How can anyone enter into the strong man's house? Okay, the word tis there is being translated as anyone. How can anyone enter in? Or how can someone, I suppose you could translate it that way too. But it's making a kind of categorical statement, anyone might be more appropriate. So it's an indefinite pronoun here. We don't know who it is, but it could be anyone. John 3:3, Eon me tis genethe anothen. Unless one is born again, unless someone is born again, or unless anyone is born again, that, you know, any of those possible translations. Here they're translating it one, unless one is born again, or unless a certain person is born again. There's a number of possibilities, kind of depending on what you sense from the context. Yes, Greg? If one is not born again, you know, you can, that's another way to translate that. Unless is kind of an English negation that way too. Mm-hmm. But if you take aeon me, that's kind of a good rule of thumb or guide to use, you know, to try to remember how aeon me should be translated. If you take it, if not, you know, it pretty well will give you the sense of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. And you got the subjunctive there too, so you got this hypothetical situation. Okay, Matthew 9:3, it do tines ton grammateon epon en heautois. Some or certain of the scribes said among themselves. So certain of the scribes, certain ones among the scribes. Since you have this now with a genitive phrase after it, certain, maybe a little bit more, some or certain, because you have a genitive phrase following some of this group or certain of this group. And so sometimes it's that genitive phrase will help you decide how to translate it. Luke 9:49, e damen tena en to onomati su ek balanta daimonia. Daimonia. We saw someone casting out demons in your name. Again, we saw someone tena. Now it's an accusative case, of course. It's the direct object. We saw someone. And again, we saw a certain one that could be translated. We saw someone. Probably not anyone in this case because they did see a certain one. They just didn't specify who it was. Luke 1:40, echo soy t a pen. I have something to say to you. Here it's in the neuter, t, and it's I have something to say to you, because you say things, you don't say people. Okay, Hebrews 3:4, pascar oikos kataskuazatai hypotenos. For every house is built by someone. And then hupo here with the genitive, remember, is your normal way of expressing agency, direct agency. And tenos, the agent now is unspecified. But in other words, you might say the agent is specified, but indefinitely. But it's by someone. So we may not know who the someone is, but anybody with any kind of intelligence recognizes that a house doesn't spontaneously generate itself. It's built by someone. In other words, that's the intrinsic argument from design. Houses just don't appear of their own accord. Okay, 1 Thessalonians, neither do people. 1 Thessalonians 5:15. Orate me tis kakon anti kaku tini apodo. See that no one returns evil for evil to anyone. So we've got no one, we've got me with the tis there, so not anyone. See that not anyone, evil against evil, to anyone returns or gives back, gives away. You know, so it's the idea of retaliation. And here you have both of them in the indefinite. The first one, the subject, negated and indefinite, and then the object also indefinite. Any questions? Yes, Mark?
I'm not sure whether you mentioned it or not, but if these were used in question, we expect them at the front of the sentence.
Usually with questions, you'll see it at either the front of the sentence or the beginning of a clause. You'll see it there. The position's going to tip you off. You can't always count on that, you know, without any question, because even these indefinites could conceivably come at the beginning. But usually that's a good rule of thumb, that the interrogatives are going to come right at the beginning. And then, of course, your accent difference. So it may not be that you're going to see a lot of confusion on this, but it can, you know, because Greek word order being what it is, you can expect that there'll be some ambiguities on it. Okay. Section 2, the indefinite tis or t may also function as an adjective with anarthrous noun. It then means any, some, a certain. In other words, you can have the word tis, but also another more definite noun, and then you're, in effect, talking about any one of that class or a certain one within a certain class. So it's functioning adjectively here. And Luke 15:11, anthropos tis echen duo. Who use? A certain man had two sons. Now, anthropos tis would be a certain man. It could also be tis anthropos too. Usually, I guess it's more often than not you'll see it following, but you'll find it in front too in some of these examples. And of course, it's an anarthrous noun because you're not talking about a definite the man. It's a certain man, so you've got an anarthrous noun. You've got this thing functioning as an adjective. Remember, an adjective on an anarthrous noun can either be in front or behind the noun. We don't really specify positions with those because that's with reference to the article. Luke 18:2, krites tis ein en tini pole. A certain judge was in a certain city. Here you have two indefinite uses of the adjectival function of tis. Krites tis, a certain judge, and then tini pole, a certain city. And there you see the tis coming in front of the noun, one and following the other. So that's a good example. You can kind of see all the various ways it's used that way. Acts 15:36, meta de tenas hemeras sepen pros Barnaban Paulos. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas. After certain days, after some days. Again, tenas hemeras. Tenas functioning clearly as an adjective here. And then 1 Timothy 5:24, tenon anthropon hai hamartiai pro de loi asin. The sins of some men are conspicuous. Okay, some men here, tenon anthropon, genitive plural, again coming in front of the noun, functioning like an adjective. I suppose in these uses where you're functioning like an adjective, you know, it could be a debate as to whether it's an adjective or a noun in apposition to another noun or whatever, but that debate could be waged against adjectives in general. Yes?
Acts like an article.
In a way, it's almost acting like an indefinite article, you might say, giving a definite idea of indefiniteness, you might say. Can you understand that? In other words, without an article, you could have just a man, and you've got an indefinite sense already without the article. But putting tinos in there, or putting tis in there, a form of that, will make it unambiguous that the thing is indefinite, that you're really putting, you know, a clear emphasis on the indefiniteness of the concept. So it wouldn't, I don't think it would be quite analogous to the English indefinite article, but it would be really specifying the indefiniteness, making it clear that it was indefinite, you might say, that you really intended it to be such. Maybe a higher degree of indefiniteness, you might say. Okay, any other questions on those indefinite pronouns? All right. Indefinite adverbs. This is kind of a catch-all category, but none of the words we're going to look at in this section are ones that we haven't seen before. The indefinite adverbs which occur in the New Testament are pote, or pote, with no accent on either syllable, which means that sometime or other, once, formerly, at times. It's if you compare the interrogative pote, again, we have the same kind of an idea, an accent shift using the same word. Pote meant when, is a question word. And now, if you shift the accent, pote, then you get at some time, or once, or formerly, or at times. Again, it's dealing with time. It's a time-oriented word. Then you have poo, or poo without any accent, somewhere, about, with, and then with numbers. It's about with numbers, about, you know, in other words, somewhere in the area of the idea. Still got the idea of somewhere, but when it's used very often with numbers, where you're approximating a number, it's approximately this, or it's within the vicinity of this, so you still got this idea of a spatial concept. And notice your interrogative form, poo, with the circumflex accent. The difference now is the circumflex versus the acute, or no accent. There's pos, or pos with no accent, somehow. Then we had the interrogative form, pos, meaning how, with the circumflex. Now, the use of these adverbs requires some explanation. First, pote here, and he's got three categories for this. First, when the context points to future time, pote means ever, at any time, or at some time, or once. Now, this is probably something you'll pick up from context anyway. You may not even have to stop and think. Excuse me. Stop and think that is it future time, or is it past time, whatever. It'll probably just sound natural to you one way or the other. But look at the example here. Luke 22:32, su pote epistrepsas stereson tus adelphusu. Once you are converted, strengthen your brethren. Okay, we've got a circumstantial aorist participle here, and the pote modifying that whole thing. So once you are converted, strengthen your brethren. And he's giving a future sense here, even though there is no future form here. You just have a aorist participle and an imperative form. But the idea is it's speaking of, and when you're making a command, it's almost always got a certain kind of a future sense. I mean, you're expecting the action to take place in the future. And so that's what he's getting at. And you're translating this once. In other words, once this has happened, then something else will happen. Or something else is being requested to happen. When the context points to past time, pote means once or formerly. And again, they're translating pretty much the same, once, although formerly might be appropriate too. Romans 7:9, ego de ezon choris nomu pote. I was formerly alive apart from the law, or I was once alive apart from the law, referring to something that took place in the past. So it was almost like the idea, I was once at that time, you know, alive without the law. And then John 9:13, agusin oton prostus pharisaius ton pote tuflon. They led him who was once blind to the Pharisees. Okay, here you're using pota as almost an adjective here. It's functioning like an adjective. And we've seen adverbs functioning like adjectives before. But it's tone pota to flown. The blind man once, the once being blind man, the one who was blind man once at one time. So there's an interesting use of it as a technically functioning like an adjective, although it's an adverb. And it's not declined, fortunately. Okay, then thirdly, in combination with other words, we have examples here. A day pota, now at last. We've seen a day before. So Romans 1:10, de omenos a post a day pota, eudofesomai, ento thelemati tu theu elfein pros humas, asking whether perhaps now at last I shall succeed by God's will to come to you. So whether now at last, a day pota, now at last is the idea, now once and for all or something like that, you get that idea, now at last. Then a few other examples here, we have u and then pota, so combination using u first and then pota, u giving your negative idea, and so I like to think of this one more as it says never or not ever. You might think of not at any time, you know, to get that idea of pota back there. You could almost take it even just literally the way it is, not at any time. And, of course, that's got the idea of never. So 2 Peter 1:21, ugar thelemati anthropou enikthe prophetea pota, for prophecy never was brought by man's will. Well, you might say prophecy was not brought at any time by man's will. That would give you keep it fairly literal.
Which is stronger than what the King James has here for, I think it says, for prophecy came not.
Yeah, came not. That's real weak, sure. Yeah, when you see upote there, that pote there, see, what they're translating as though pote wasn't even in there. It's just translating as if it was only u. But it's not any time. It's emphatic. It's somewhat akin to that double negative we've seen, that ume. It's got a lot more force. It's never, not at any time. Okay. Those are little things that it's good to notice from time to time. King James just glosses over. Then another example, tis pota, who in the world. Now, that's obviously a very loose translation, because there's nothing in pota that has to do with world. It's not, you know, en gay or something. It's pota. And I would prefer translating who at any time. Who at any time. And just take it literally. It makes all the sense, and as much sense as the idea of who in the world. So tis stratuetai idiois opsonois, that's a good word, pota. If they translate who in the world serves as a soldier at his own expense, I would translate it who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense. Makes as much sense, and it's more literal. Somebody look at that who in the world and imagine there's the word gay is there in Greek and so forth. I mean, why do it that way? I mean, maybe it's idiomatic, but it's not literal. Okay, me pota. Yes, question, Glenn?
That form, although it's identical to page 299, section 2, I think it's a certain soldier serves as an
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. There's an example where this tis comes in the first position, and you'd have to go by context and try to decide, you know, if he's giving an argument that way.
Although, isn't soldier, isn't it plural?
Well, it's a deponent verb. It just means serve as a soldier. It's a verb form.
Verb.
Yeah, it's a verb form. So who?
Oh, so excuse me, man. I'm sorry. I lost
my now. Oh, I see. Okay, that's what you're thinking. Yeah, yeah. And this one, a certain one, you might be able to make that into if you took the accent off it. Let me see a certain. It's not the adjectival function though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because that is a verb form. Yes, they're, what they're doing, there is the word for soldier that's built from this, but this is the verb form. So this means to serve as a soldier, to soldier, you know. Yeah, you don't have, we don't usually think of it that way. But. Okay, any other question? All right, then may pote is one word. With the indicative, again, never, and like I said, this might be the same sense as what we see, u pote above, not at any time. And now with the may, of course, with the, it says with the indicative, it can be used as never. And you may see this with the indicative also, Hebrews 9:17, epe me pote esque, since it is never in force, it is not at any time in force. And then with the subjunctive, which you're more likely to see, you're used to seeing mays with, lest or that not, I would say maybe more even, again, lest at any time, because you can just get lest from the may alone. So again, I would try to put something more in there to show that represent the pota in there. So maybe lest at any time would be even more emphatic. So apolusai autus nestes uthelo me pota ek luthosin ento hodo. I do not wish to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. Lest at any time they faint on the way. Maybe a little bit better, because it's a little bit more emphatic than just saying lest. As an interrogative adverb with the indicative, this is, again, using it as a question word. And me pote alethos egnosan hoi archontes. Just remember that when you use may for a question, may introduced a question, you're asking for a negative answer. So they give, have the authorities really come to know, or the authorities haven't come to know, have they? That kind of idea. It's asking for a no answer. But here, how would we translate this? You can't really do it any time. Maybe something like this. They put really in here. Well, no, alephos is what they're getting the really from. So they really don't have anything equivalent to this. It's stronger than though they're just asking for, you know, you could use may just to get the ordinary idea. Something along the lines of, have the authorities really at any time ever come to know? Have they really, you know, the alephos plus the may pota really gives a strong, powerful sense to it. Maybe intonation is what you have to do to get the sense across. Maybe put an underline under really. Have they really come to know?
Is this also affecting the negative?
Yeah, I think it is. It's the same kind of construction. And it kind of depends on how you set up the question word-wise in English. The idea is that you can see a sense of a certain amount of skepticism. They don't really believe that the authorities have come to know. So they're kind of expecting a no answer. Again, it's an expectation. It's not necessarily the case that it couldn't get a yes answer to a question like that. It's just that the person who's asking it is expecting no answer. They haven't really come to know, have they? You know. Okay, then poo. Several possible uses for that. It's rarely used alone, meaning somewhere, with the meaning somewhere. And that's pretty much analogous to where, to the way it's used as an interrogative. Hebrews 4:4, ereken gar poo perites ebdomes utos, for he has somewhere spoken thus concerning the seventh day. So somewhere, just kind of indefinite, somewhere, poo, somewhere. And of course, this is referring to somewhere in the scripture. Then secondly, with numbers and numeral expressions, meaning about, this is that sense where it's approximately, it's where you're not trying to specify exact numbers, but approximately. So, and the idea is, even in our mind, we're talking about...
this number. So he's supposed to be talking in a place analogy anyway. So Hikaton may a place to the Barcon, being about 100 years old. And the poo is just stuck in there as a bit of an adverb there to give you approximately 100 years old. Then, in combination with other words, de-pu, or de-pu is one word, clearly, of course, Hebrews 2:16, uga de-pu, angelon epilambanatai, for surely he is not concerned with angels. De-pu here giving, I'm not sure what kind of a literal sense he'd get from that. I don't know if it's used enough to really give a sense of it. Not de, we're wishing death, but they, I'm not sure what the consent, it doesn't ring a bell to me. Yeah, that would be interesting to see if it's got a meaning by itself. Someone might want to look it up. If it is, it may not be used by itself, but we can find it in there. And then Meku left somewhere. Not really making sense again, because you got this idea of a negative, and then you got somewhere, a place involved here. So Acts 27:29, Obumanoi te Meku Tata. Hearing lest we might somewhere run on rough places, lest we might somewhere. So we're seeing lest at any time, now we got lest we might somewhere, and he's talking about space, run on rough places someplace. So it's just the same kind of an image, but now with place rather than time. Yes, John, did you find anything on that? Okay. Okay, anybody else? Yes. Oh, that's a good question. I thought it looked familiar, but he's got... So he told, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, he just emphasized a different element of it. Uh-huh. Now, the post has got the now at last idea, and then the post is what he's giving you, the weather now, weather somehow. He translates them both differently, you know, depending on how you put the emphasis. Interesting. Of course, when you get so loose, it can be very inconsistent. That's one of the problems with these translations, is that you lose consistency throughout the text, you know. And I suppose that's probably one of the things that I'm most concerned about, just because in execution, it's really important to be able to see what fits the connection of a scripture. And if you're not consistent in the translation of certain phrases and so forth, then it's going to smite you later on, and you'll miss connections if it wasn't from the English that you would have gotten otherwise. Okay, well, let me give you a partial assignment here. Well, this chapter, I guess this one's pretty short, and all you see mostly is just fill in the blanks of one of these forms, so we'll do that. 48, A, B, C, D, and E. We'll go ahead and do the whole thing on that one, but it's short. Most of them you just have to fill in one word. So I hope this one will be easier than the last one. And we'll do that. We'll go through that next Tuesday. So all of 48 then. And I'll give you a break on 49. I may not even assign you anything on 49. And 50, we'll take just a short piece. So this is just the last big exercise. Yeah. So we're rounding the bend, getting close to the home stretch. Yeah. I'm in this chapter. Go ahead and ask them now then. Yeah.
The first
one was
you're more inclined to see a construction like this.
should be we, so we have no root in ourselves, if that's correct. In other words, if he's rendered the verb, either he made a mistake in recording the Greek verb from that verse, or he made a mistake in translating it. Maybe you can check there and see if it's a mistake in the verb. Yeah. Okay. So a day Christian, that's what he did. He got the translation right, but he got the Greek wrong. Okay, good. I'm glad you caught that. Looks like he's got either his proofreaders are a little weak in this chapter, near the end of the book they're getting tired or something. Yeah, Ekusin. Yeah, Ekusin. Someone may have a brain spelling. So third person plural. And his translation is correct. You don't need the same thing. His translation is simple. Okay? Do you have another one? Did you find another one? No. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he never mentioned all the examples he gave you without us before, as himself and so forth, with just with a third person. But here we've seen ego tell us, and it can work with the first, second person. It's probably pretty rare. You're not going to see it very frequently, but it will work that way. And I suppose there's a certain amount of confusion because the pronoun outsourced as an independent pronoun form is always third person. But when it's used in this intensive sense, emphatic sense, then it can go on first, second, or third person form. But I wasn't even serious about that before. Okay, anyone else? Okay, giving you the assignment already, so let's go to chapter 49, the vocative and other uses of the cases. This is more of a grammatical chapter, just looking at the way things, you don't have any new forms to learn except for the vocative case, and even there, it's not much in the way of form. Section 380, the vocative case. The fifth and last of the Greek cases is called the vocative. Now, many of you are familiar with the eight case system as well as the Hebrew. It's kind of a four case with a kind of five, the fifth case for the vocative once in a while. And then there's others that argue for eight cases. And we're going to get into that controversy this real soon here. After we're done with the book here, we're going to start getting into case functions and other things. And it's a debate that rages on, some are arguing adamantly for eight, and others are arguing for five or four. And really, to me, both have some points. There's only four different forms. You possibly shift with the vocative, where sometimes you have another form. But eight functions, and if you define it by function, you're going to come up with eight. If you define it by form, you come up with four or five. And so that's usually how it breaks down. And in my mind, I don't have to decide which one's right. I just have to recognize that there's four forms and eight functions. No problem. And then, although those eight functions, there may be a little bit of debate about, we'll get into this question, instrumental, dative, locative. I think that there may be more commonality to those than many see, but I'll give you some insight in that a little bit later on. The vocative case, then, the fifth and last degree case is called the vocative. The vocative does not exist as a separate case form for all nouns, and does not exist as a separate case form at all except in the singular number. So only in the singular, and only with a few nouns, not with all of them, will you see any difference in the forms of the vocative. The rest of them are going to have the same form as the nominative case. So generally, there won't be any difference between the nominative case and the vocative case. But in a few nouns, there is a difference. So the vocative case exists as a separate case form for category one, some masculine nouns of the first declension. There are those ones ending in 80 sigma, masculine nouns of the first declension. The case number suffix is alpha, except for hades, meaning hell or Hades, which has a vocative hades. So there's one with a vocative just a native. But the rest of them have a vocative ending as an alpha, at least certain ones of these. Now, don't generalize and make all masculine nouns of the first declension do this. They don't. Just certain ones. To get some examples, I don't know how many total there are, but here's a few examples. Despotes, it has the vocative despota, and epistates, master, has vocative epistata. Hippocrates has a vocative Hippocrita and Agrippas as the vocative form Agrippa. So there you see examples of the eta sigma changing to an alpha for the vocative case. The only conceivable thing you might ever get confused with that alpha would be a neuter plural, you know, but that wouldn't be a problem in most of these cases. Now, second category, about 30 masculine nouns of the second declension have a separate vocative form, and their ending is an epsilon. You may have seen this from time to time. Especially, for example, Curio says the vocative Curia. He was saying, "Oh Lord," addressing him. It'd be Curia. And Thanatos has the vocative Thanata. Oh death, history, and so forth. In that one usage in the New Testament where, you know, usually you're not going to see death addressed, you know. You do see that personification in Christian history.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the vocative form there. And then thirdly, the following nouns of the third declension have vocatives which occur in the New Testament. There is no case number suffix, but the case of each noun is altered as indicated. So here are some other nouns that are just no special category. There's been a change of some sort in the form. And Gunae, for example, has a vocative Gunae. Pater has a vocative Pater. And just the epsilon instead of the eta. Sugater has a vocative Sugater. And aner has a vocative aner with that epsilon. Baxilis has a vocative Baxilis with the sigma dropped off. So there's no regular pattern of those. I guess those eta rows generally go to epsilon row, but other than that, there's no way to predict what's happening here. And then fourthly, the masculine form of adjectives of the first and second declensions may have a vocative in epsilon. This would be somewhat analogous to the second category up here, where the certain masculine nouns have an epsilon. So, example, Luke 1:3, Quatriste Theophile, most excellent Theophilus. It's an address now in a letter. And the adjective excellent as well as the noun Theophile is taking the epsilon. Then as a remark, the definite article has no vocative form. So you're not going to have a separate form for the article. And we've had a paradigm of the article already, and there's no separate form for the article in the vocative. You're just going to use either the nominative if it's going to be needed, but nouns in the vocative are sometimes preceded by O, and it's the same as in English, O. O king, you know, O so-and-so. And but this is an interjection, not a form of the article, so don't confuse this with the form of the article. It's only an interjection, just like our word English. Interjection is what you call things you don't know what else to call. You know? It's a word thrown in for emotional impact, I suppose. So, and it's just an omega with the food breathing in the first place. Okay, the meaning of the vocative. Vocative case indicates the person or personified thing addressed by the speaker. It can be a person or a personified thing. Using the vocative case for an inanimate object is an automatic personification. Because if you address, are you talking to something, you're giving it attributes of a person that can hear you and so forth. So this will be seen in personification quite frequently, poetic things and so forth. And then, of course, if it's really a person, then you'll see vocative forms. When there's an address, so it's going to be part of the conversation. You could, or an address, etc. Okay, a few examples here. Luke 2:29. Nu napolue ton dulon su despota. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart. So despota is addressing Lord, and then in this case the statement comes first. Luke 8:24. Epistata, epistata, apolumata. Master, master, we are perishing. Again, a vocative address to the master. Matthew 7:5, Hippocrita, ekbale, proton, ekton, osamu, to retain dokon. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your eye. Or, oh hypocrite, in other words, you're talking to the hypocrite directly. Mark 15:28, O gunai, megale, to Jesus. O woman, great is your faith. And there's the interjection, O there. Matthew 20:30, have mercy on us, son of David. So Huyeh, there's your Huyos with the vocative epsilon. O son of David, maybe. And then here's a clear example, Matthew 27:46. Ta'af mu, hinati, Ekatelepet. My God, why hast thou forsaken? My God, again, it's addressed here, Te'emu, Te'emu. Oh, my God, it's a evocative address. And it's that old, then with the epsilon ending, just like Kuya that we saw before. Yes. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that one. Hina T. It's probably the Hina and then T stuck on the end. So, yeah, in order of what, or because, in order that what, and the idea of why, to what end, to what reason, for what reason, something like that. That would be my guess. I'm sure it's from Hina and T. In order that what have you forsaken me, you know, for what reason have you forsaken me? And then we get why and for what reason. Do they break it down there?
Why is it
for
wherefore?
Mm-hmm. Do they break it down from Hina and T? Yeah. Okay. Good. Then that 26:27 says, "Q8 Basilu Agrippa." There, do you believe, King Agrippa? Oh, King Agrippa. Then you got Basilu, that's the evocative form, and then Agrippa. These are two nouns in apposition, right there. One's the proper name, and one's the title, and both in the evocative case. So that's about the size of the evocative. It's really not a big problem. It's using the case of address, but the biggest problem is that you don't. Some forms have a separate evocative form, and others don't. Yes. That will happen. Now you are letting your servant depart. It may be done just out of respect and not. So you're addressing somebody who's above you. And sometimes it's, you know, anybody who's beneath is a little bit reticent to give a command. And so that may be the sense there. I have to look at the rest of the context too to see. Yeah, it would just be a present tense form. Now you are letting the servant depart. That's probably, that'd be my sense. You see something like that in Hebrew too. They put a particle na in the end and try to be real polite, especially when you're talking to somebody that's above you. And you're kind of imploring them. It's not so much a command, but a request in that sense. It takes some of the edge, a rough edge off it. So that may be the case there. Unless they've transcribed the verb form wrong again. After running into a few of those, you're not so sure anymore. Okay, other uses of the cases. So this is more in grammatical function now, and other ways that the cases will be used, and of course we'll elaborate on this in more detail once we get into Dane and Matthew. But the nominative case, the principal function of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of a sentence or clause. The only other function we have noticed up to now is that of indicating the predicate nominative. In addition to these functions, the nominative also serves. We've already seen it as a indicating subject and indicating predicate nominative, which is quite a, you know, pretty much an analogous function. Now, in category A, in place of the vocative, whether the noun involved actually has a vocative or not, when the nominative is so used, it may have an article. So you may see the nominative with the article being used like the vocative. And in cases where the noun itself may even have a vocative form, you may see the nominative form. For example, ho kurios mu, kai ho theos mu. Both kurios and theos have vocative forms. It could have been kurias mu, kai ho theas mu. But instead, we're seeing the nominative form functioning like a vocative. And it's more of, you know, an exclamation here. And I suppose, too, it's an address, but it may be, you know, he's not going on to with a long dissertation after that. He's just, it's more of an exclamation like this. So there may be some debate as to whether this is really a vocative case. The next example is pretty clear, though. Mark 5:41. So corazón, soy lego egere. Little girl, I say to you, arise. And there, again, it's a nominative form, but it's got a function like vocative. Okay. We're out of time here, so we'll finish up this chapter after we go through the exercises next week. Try to get some rest. Yeah? Oh, evocative?
Right.
Yeah.
They have slightly different forms.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got slightly different. Some of the forms are slightly different. That's about about the size of it as far as form and as far as function, too. You can see addressing somebody and drawing your attention to them is...